From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Edward Villella was one of the greatest male stars of American ballet. Now he's artistic director of the Miami City Ballet. On today's Fresh Air, Villella tells us how he broke nine toes. Also today we meet novelist Tom Robbins, author of Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, Still Life with Woodpecker, and a new book, Skinny Legs and All. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz introduces us to another side of cellist Pablo Casals, conducting. And commentator Maureen Corrigan goes to Hollywood and gets starstruck. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The FBI has announced the arrest of a man accused of participating in the 1976 car bomb murder in Washington of a former Chilean diplomat and an American woman. NPR's Paz Cohen has the story.
José Dionisio Suárez, a militant anti-Castro Cuban, is accused of being part of the team that built and planted the bomb that killed former Chilean ambassador Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Carpin Moffat as they drove to work on September 21, 1976. Letelier was living here in exile from the dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet and was a leading spokesman against USAID to Pinochet's regime, which had overthrown the elected government in a bloody 1973 coup. Pinochet gave up the presidency only last month, but is still commander-in-chief of Chile's armed forces. A U.S. citizen who worked with Pinochet's secret police confessed he recruited Suárez and other Cuban exiles to plant the bomb on orders of superiors in Chile. I'm Paz Cohen in Washington.
An American Army sergeant has been charged with a murder and three counts of assault stemming from incidents that allegedly happened during the U.S. invasion of Panama. Army officials say that First Sergeant Roberto Bryan, stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, has been charged with the premeditated murder of an unarmed Panamanian man and assault against three other men. The men were reportedly riding in a car from which a hand grenade was thrown. President Bush today fulfilled a promise to issue an executive order to prevent Chinese students visiting in the U.S. from being forced to return home. Students have claimed that they'll be persecuted for their support of last year's pro-democracy movement. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Back in November, when President Bush vetoed legislation that would have provided safeguards for Chinese students, he promised to issue an executive order that would do the same thing. But last week, there were reports that the president never actually issued the order. The White House scrambled for explanations amid outcries by critics. On Friday, the president again promised to issue the executive order. The order issued today directs U.S. Attorney General Richard Thornburgh to take any steps necessary until 1994 to prevent the enforced departure of all Chinese nationals and their dependents. It also waives passport requirements and substitutes travel documents when necessary. The executive order is effective immediately. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
At least seven people are reported dead today in a car bomb explosion near the Colombian city of Medellin. A local radio station says that the bomb was planted outside a police barracks just south of the reputed cocaine capital. 22 people were reported injured in the incident. On Wall Street today, stock prices were mixed at the close. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down just over a point at 2,729.7. This is NPR News. The man accused of 87 arson-related murders in last month's fire at an illegal New York social club pleaded not guilty today. Julio Gonzalez, a Cuban immigrant, was arraigned on 174 counts of murder, two for each of the 87 victims in what authorities say is the worst mass murder in U.S. history. The 36-year-old Gonzalez is accused of setting the fire at the Happy Land Social Club in the Bronx after a fight with a former girlfriend who worked at the club. Gonzalez is being evaluated at the psychiatric ward of Bellevue Hospital. A judge in Chicago today ruled that an 11-year-old boy named Tony should be allowed to see his younger brother. Tony and his brother Sam were adopted together 5 years ago, and this November, the couple that adopted them returned Tony to the orphanage and wouldn't let the two brothers visit each other. Ira Glass reports from Chicago.
Judge Walter Williams was the original judge in this case, and when it came before him again today, he said the two sides didn't understand his original ruling, that the first time around he hadn't actually addressed the question of Tony visiting his brother, and that of course it would be permitted. He then ordered nightly phone calls and weekly visits for the two boys. Cook County Public Guardian Patrick Murphy was Tony's attorney in the case.
The judge was very defensive. I don't blame him, but he made a very good decision at the end, and Tony's going to be elated about this.
Patrick Murphy said an investigation was underway to see if the younger brother should be taken from these adoptive parents and placed in the same home as Tony. Over 10% of all adoptions end with the adoptive parents returning the children to the state. I'm Ira Glass in Chicago.
Mother Teresa, the Roman Catholic nun who won a Nobel Peace Prize for her work among India's poor, announced today that she's retiring as the head of her religious order. Mother Teresa founded the Missionaries of Charity in Calcutta in 1950. The 79-year-old nun suffered a heart attack last year, and a spokesman for the Vatican said that she was retiring for health reasons. Since its founding, the Missionaries of Charity has spread to 87 countries. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Edward Villella is one of the most acclaimed American male dancers of our time. Dance critic Arlene Croce wrote, "The Villella repertory, both the roles he originated and those he assumed with special distinction, is the greatest corpus of ballets created for a male dancer in this century." Yet Villella broke a lot of the popular stereotypes of ballet dancers. He was a New Yorker from an Italian-American working-class family, and he was an athlete, a college welterweight champion. Villella joined the New York City Ballet in 1957, and in 1960 became a principal dancer under George Balanchine's direction. Villella's TV appearances spread his fame beyond the dance world. Now Villella is carrying on the Balanchine tradition as the founding artistic director of the Miami City Ballet. The company is only 4 years old, but it's already considered among the top regional companies in America. Villella sustained many injuries during his career as a dancer: back trouble, bad knees, 9 broken toes, and stress fractures on each shin. When he retired from dancing, he had a hip replacement. I asked him if he thought this was an uncommon number of injuries.
Well, it might be more typical of people of my generation, and people of my generation who were principal dancers functioning, for instance, in live television. In live television, we danced only on cement stages.
Mm-hmm.
The cameras in those days were so enormous that you couldn't have a wooden or soft floor. You had to have cement.
Wait. The cameras were so enormous
were so heavy.
Oh, of course. You needed the cement floor to support it.
To support the weight of those enormous instruments. Now, of course, the miniaturization of electronics has allowed these cameras to be much smaller. And you can put them on wooden floors and linoleum-covered wooden floors.
And you were known especially for your leaps and jumps, so you'd land hard, I guess.
The landings were the devastations. I broke 9 toes on cement in television in those early days. But I was also a person within the New York City Ballet who had the great fortune to dance most of that repertoire. And I would do 2, 3, 4 ballets a night. Also, I was at a time when there were not that many bravura male dancers, so I was called upon to do an awful lot of that stuff. Plus, I just loved dancing, and I found it hard to say no. I just danced everywhere and anywhere.
When you had your hip replacement surgery, was that still in its experimental stages, and were you worried about it? Were you warned against it at the time?
Well, when that occurred to me, there was I considered a very primitive operation, and I was told that it had a life expectancy of 16 years, and it was really designed for much older people. And I was 40 years old at the time, and I just didn't think that that was a good idea. And I said that to my doctor, and I said, I believe in medical science, and I'm going to wait this out. And he said, well, you may not be able to handle the pain, because it's the equivalent, or so I was told, of a broken bone. So it was 24-hour pain. And for 5 1/4 years, I didn't sleep 2 hours back to back. But I decided I was just going to deal with that and wait for a new operation. After 4 years, a new operation occurred. I then said to my doctor, I would wait 1 more year and let them get version 2 of this operation, because anything new certainly is improved after a year's time. And I now have a version 2 of the operation I had 10 years ago. And I am very happy to say it still serves me very well. And don't tell my doctor, but I abuse it.
How do you abuse it?
Well, I jump up and down on it. You know, it's It's not the kind of thing that you should challenge. I mean, it allows you to walk and run and lead a normal life, but it really is not designed to be demonstrating entre-chassis and double air tours and things like that. And I somehow can't help myself. I know I shouldn't do it, but it's what my life is about is moving, and I find it very difficult not to move. But at any rate, since that operation, there is now an even more contemporary one that is highly, highly successful.
But you wouldn't want to go through that again.
I would prefer not to.
Right. Edward Villella is my guest. I was just watching a clip of you performing on the Ed Sullivan Show. I'm not sure what year it's from, but I think we can assume it's from probably the early 60s or something. And so you do this fabulous dance. I'm not sure who the ballerina you were dancing with was. Then Sullivan comes out after the performance is over, and he says, beautiful dancing, Edward Villella, where are you from? And you say, Bayside, Long Island. And you laugh, and he laughs. And he asks the ballerina, where are you from? And she says, Teaneck, New Jersey. And everybody's hysterical. What's so funny about that?
I'm amused by it now myself. I think that in those early days, people expected you to be from France or Italy or the Soviet Union, or you couldn't be American, good heavens, to be a classical ballet dancer. I think people simply Europeanized in their minds the stereotypical person. So I think that was one of the first indications that we're unaccustomed to this. This is a very, very young art form in this country. And thank heavens for the New York City Ballet and George Balanchine and people like Jerome Robbins, who Americanized classicism. When Balanchine went with the New York City Ballet for the first time to the Soviet Union in 1962, some of the officials there said, well, welcome back to the land of classicism. And Balanchine said, no, classicism now lives in America. So we now have, lo these many years, a true American classicism, which is now international. It is the new classicism, which really is showing us the way.
So you no longer would be laughed at from being at Bayside.
No, I think it's not quite as amusing as it used to be.
Right. You were from an Italian-American family.
Yes.
Was that considered even more unusual?
Oh, extraordinarily. My father was somewhat taken aback by this whole thing. He really was a somewhat backward-looking Italian-American. And my mother was the forward-looking person. And you have to understand that it wasn't only that art and classicism and ballet were an oddity in any Italian family, but a young boy, that was a totally different and new concept. And as a matter of fact, I danced only because my sister was dancing.
Yes, this story is part of ballet folklore now, I think. Why don't you tell the story about how you started dancing?
Well, my mother was an orphan, and she loved to dance and never had the opportunity. So when she had a daughter, she thought that was a way that she might vicariously touch this. And she used to take my sister off to a local ballet school in Queens, and I used to hang out in the streets and get into physical trouble. I was just a very physical kid, until one day I got knocked unconscious by a baseball and dragged home by my friends unconscious. And my mother was away with my sister, and she said from that time on I needed to go to my sister's school because she couldn't trust me on the streets anymore. And there were 40 giggling girls, their mothers and me, and I was bored to tears, and I couldn't sit still. And then they started to jump, and I went in the back of the room and started to jump with them. And I disrupted the class, and the teacher said she would only allow me to stay if I joined. And I was humiliated, but I was made to do it. And then in 6 months' time, I began to love what this stuff was. I was very physical, and I did all of those sandlot athletics and so on. But this was so much beyond it. I mean, it had such depth, it had development, it had structure, it had form, it had music, it had a physical language that you could speak with your body, and all of that made a great deal of sense to me, and I loved it. I went for about 5 or 6 years till I was about 16. My sister quit. I was made to quit. My father decided I should go to a military school. I'm a graduate of
the... Make you a real man.
You're right. So I'm a graduate of the New York State Maritime College. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in Marine Transportation.
Did you have to hide from your fellow students at the maritime school that you loved ballet and that you danced ballet?
No, because I was also a welterweight boxing champion.
So you could take care of them, right?
I could speak a physical language.
So your parents didn't want you to dance professionally.
No.
They put you into the maritime college. You were there for 4 years, and you got back into ballet afterwards. How did you get back in?
Well, in my last year, I decided, frustration and aside, I needed to move forward and do what I wanted to do, and I started going into the city, to New York City, and started taking some classes. And after I got myself into some kind of shape, I presented myself to Balanchine, and he offered me a job. And when I graduated, I told my parents this, and they basically didn't speak to me for about a year. But I sent them tickets to our opening night of the second season that I was with in New York City Ballet, and they expected to find it difficult to find me in the back line. However, there were four ballets on that evening, and I had three principal roles. And at the end of the evening, they were standing in the wings in tears, and the three of us stood on the stage laughing, hugging, and crying. And from that time on, my father became a balletomane. He ran a trucking business in the garment center, so he didn't really have that aesthetic background to understand what I was doing. But from that time on, I mean, he used to hand my pictures out in the garment center in my reviews.
What was he initially so worried about in terms of a career in dance? Was it the difficulty of making a living in dance, or was it how was I going to explain to my friends that my son is a ballet dancer?
I think he was more practical, and he thought mm-hmm. that at that time, in particular, it wasn't a good and easy living.
Yeah.
You know, the New York City Ballet maybe worked about 5 or 6 months, 6 or 7 months a year at that time, and the salaries were not extraordinary. So it didn't make for a very, very bright financial future. So I think he was very concerned about that. He said, you know, you'll break an ankle, and then what do? You need an education. And I'm delighted he felt that way, and my mother felt that way.
So he was very concerned about how you'd make a living in dance. You've been described as one of the first American male ballet dancers to really make quite a living at dance. I mean, did you feel compelled to prove that you could do it, that was possible because of your parents' reaction?
Yeah, possibly. First of all, I thought we all worked very hard and we weren't paid very well. I also thought that other people, other than Americans, who were talented and wonderful, who might be compatible with us, were making so much more money than we. And I determined that was something I, for myself, but also for other dancers, and for the entire American dance field, would try to raise the producers' financial appreciation of American dancers. So I started to do things like insist on Top of the Show, on the Ed Sullivan Show, or Kraft Music Hall, or Bell Telephone Hour, or any of those other things. I used to do a lot of symphony dates, and I would insist on being paid at a level commensurate with the number of people in the audience. I would dance with the Cleveland Symphony, and there would be 8,000 people out there, and a famous opera singer had been there the week before, and there were 4,000. And this opera singer was probably making two or three times what I was making, and at the intermission, they were inviting me back already. And I said, fine, but you must understand the economics of this now. And I just thought it was very important. I thought it was important that Americans started to appreciate the level of their own.
Edward Villela is my guest, and he was one of America's star dancers. He was a principal with the New York City Ballet and now is the founding artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, which has been around just for 4 years. It's still one of the very new companies, but one of the top regional companies in the country. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia. and distributed by National Public Radio.
Edward Villela is my guest, and he's now the founding artistic director of the Miami City Ballet. You've also been credited with opening up the role of the male dancer in ballet. Were there certain frustrations that you felt when you started dancing in the role of partnering, which is what so many men have so often been consigned to in ballet?
I was a disastrous partner when first started dancing, because I stopped when I was just about 16, which is the time when you learn how to partner.
Right, this is you stop to go to the Maritime College.
Right.
Yeah.
So I never had any partnering experience. And I was so incredibly naive and so full of this passion to dance. When I came back, I just threw myself into it, and I didn't think about the intricacies. I didn't think about the inside understanding of the musicalities, and et cetera. And I certainly didn't think about partnering. I thought, well, you just grab him, pick him up, and put him down. That's all you have to do. And I'm strong. I'm an athlete. I won my letters in baseball. I'm a boxing champion. That's all I have to do. I can get him up. And it unfortunately, for those ballerinas that I had to dance with in those first 3 years, I basically learned how to partner on them in front of 2,000 or 3,000 people a night. And it was terrible for those poor ladies.
What would they tell you after a performance?
Nothing. They'd be running away in tears.
Oh, gee.
It was awful. And I apologize to them publicly right now. I'm sorry.
So did that have to do with your developing jumps and leaps and bravura moves? Was that not partnering, but was that more of where you felt you fit in?
Well, you know, I had a natural ability to jump. Mm-hmm. I had a natural ability to do the pyrotechnical things. I was a very athletic kind of person, dancer, whatever. And the natural instinct is to do what you do best, and you go towards that. And it was devastating for me to understand that it wasn't just this bouncing up and down on a stage. There was much more to it. There was a whole artistry to everything, including partnering, and just a presence on stage, and style, and characterization, and relationships, and all of those things. So once I had gotten back, I thought, well, that's it. That's when you start to learn, is when the curtain goes up. And fortunately for me, it became another passion, and that was to learn stagecraft.
You danced for many years for Balanchine. You were a principal, a star of the New York City Ballet. But from what I understand, you never really got that close to him, as close as some of the other dancers did. Why not?
Well, it was not in my nature to pursue inner circle. That simply was not what I was or what I was about. The other part of it was that when I did come back, and I found after a year or two that I really didn't know what I was doing, and that I was damaging my muscles and my muscle tones, and I was creating injury, I needed something else. And I began to analyze the technique, and I began to analyze the Balanchinian approach to it. And I began to understand that it wasn't just me who was hurting and complaining about the Balanchine classes. Everybody would do it, but they wouldn't admit it to Balanchine.
What do you think was wrong with the Balanchine technique in his classes, in the way he taught?
There was nothing wrong in what he gave. It was how he gave it. He was impatient. He would sometimes give 12, 14, 16 minutes at the bar. A normal bar is 30 to 40 minutes. So there's a slower pace, there's a build. He wasn't interested in building. My assumption is that he thought everybody came warmed up to class, that you would work 20 or 30 minutes before you came to his class, and I tried that. But you see, we were dancing 8 times a week, and me in particular doing 3-4 ballets a night. It was very, very difficult to get to the studio half an hour early to prepare in the morning when you'd just gotten off stage at 11 o'clock the night before. It was physically impossible to do. And I knew it. I knew that there was going to be difficulty, but I knew it was the only way I could survive.
Edward Villella is my guest. He was a star of the New York City Ballet, one of the best-known American male ballet dancers. He's now the founding artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, one of the most acclaimed of the regional ballet companies in the States. You know, we had talked about how you were helping to show that Americans could be classical ballet dancers. In your company, the Miami City Ballet, I think about a third of the dancers are Hispanic. Is this the next frontier to prove that blacks and Hispanics and people from around the world are capable of dancing ballet?
You know, it's sort of silly when you analyze it and think about it. I mean, human beings are human beings.
Right.
And there are certain human beings, it doesn't matter where they are from, who have abilities and talents. And that's all we seek. We seek talent. And for us right now, from where we are positioned in Miami, there are a lot of Hispanics there, and Miami attracts a lot of Hispanics. So we use what's available. We use what's there, and we begin to find out that Argentina produces some wonderful dances. We found out that Venezuela produces some wonderful dances. Colombia produced some wonderful dancers. So we also have people from Europe, from Italy, from Germany, and we have an Australian. We also have a lot of Americans. I would like Americans who were born in America.
Will you be dancing in the near future?
I am a long retired dancer. However, I got a call from Jerry Robbins about 2 months ago. Jerry Robbins is resigning from the New York City Ballet, and the New York City Ballet is doing a 2-week retrospective of his works. And he called to ask if I would reprise a work he had done for me in the early 70s called Watermill. And naturally, I howled and laughed. And I said, Jerry, I don't do that anymore. And he said, no, come on, you can do it. And Watermill is a work that is really a physical theater piece. It's not a bravura role. It's simply an ability to command a stage for an hour. And I think I can still do that. I can still move. And I'm still a performer at heart. I really, really miss the stage. I really, really miss building a role and developing a role. At any rate, I asked Jerry to give me some time to think about it because I would have to get myself in shape to do it. And the next day, he had an interview with the New York Times and announced me. So it was a fait accompli. And right now, my main challenge, I've done 5 rehearsals, and they seem to go well, and I remembered most of it and so on, and Jerry and I seem to be pleased with each other. My real challenge now is to get my body in a condition where it can be presented on stage.
Well, I wish you the best with the company and with your upcoming dance performance. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Edward Villella is the artistic director of the Miami City Ballet. The ballet is performing this week in Philadelphia at the Annenberg Center. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On the next Fresh Air, journalist Robert Cullen reports on recent events in Lithuania and Romania. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tom Robbins wrote what's been called the quintessential novel of the 60s, but he bristles when he's called a 60s writer. Coming up, the author of Another Roadside Attraction and Even Cowgirls Get the Blues talks about his first novel of the 90s, Skinny Legs and All. It's pretty much agreed that the late Pablo Casals was the greatest cellist of this century. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz shows us Casals was no slouch as a conductor either. And our normally well-reasoned commentator, Maureen Corrigan, tells us how she reacted to her first run-in with an honest-to-God Hollywood movie star. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Indicating a change in thinking, Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze now says that the Soviet Union believes a unified Germany could hold membership in both NATO and the Warsaw Pact. NPR's Mike Schuster has more on the story.
Soviet Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze's proposal came in an article he wrote in a Brussels-based magazine connected to NATO. Dual membership in NATO and the Warsaw Pact could provide a way out of the current difficulties, Shevardnadze wrote. Until now, Moscow has insisted that a united Germany cannot retain its membership in NATO, while the United States and the other NATO countries have been trying to convince the Soviets that only Germany's continuing membership in NATO can guarantee Moscow's security concerns. Both the State Department and a spokesman at NATO headquarters in Brussels reacted unfavorably to Shevardnadze's proposal. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
In Washington, White House Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater says that the president believes German NATO membership is the best guarantee for long-term peace and continued stability. Officials in Romania have asked the country's former ruler, ex-King Michael, to delay his first visit home since he went into exile 42 years ago. They say they cannot guarantee his safety. But the former king has made it clear that he will not be dissuaded. Phil Jones of the BBC reports.
Spokesmen for the king's supporters here say that the government pressure on him to cancel the trip has been growing for the last 5 days. They say that he was visited at his home in Geneva by a representative of the Romanian embassy, who told him that the visit would exacerbate existing conflicts in the country and could endanger his personal safety. King Michael, however, says the visit is a private one, a pilgrimage to family graves, and he will come despite the government warnings. His arrival is on the eve of the Easter weekend. Every bit as big a festival here as Christmas, and Easter Sunday should see him worshipping in Timișoara, the cradle of the Romanian Revolution. In interviews with local papers, he said again that his abdication was invalid because it was forced upon him, and he would be willing to resume his constitutional throne if that was the wish of the people.
Phil Jones, the BBC in Bucharest. For 10 minutes today, several hundred thousand people demonstrated in Prague for the return by the Communist Party of property gained illegally in Czechoslovakia. At 10 minutes before noon today, car horns began blaring and shopkeepers closed their doors to support the strike called by the opposition movement Civic Forum chapter. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over a point today to close at 2,729.73 on volume of 141 million shares. Losers and gainers were just about even in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Most classical music fans remember Pablo Casals as the greatest cellist of the century. Casals died in 1973 at the age of 96. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz wants to remind us that Casals was also an important conductor. Lloyd has a review of a new compact disc of Casals conducting Mozart's greatest concerto for string instruments, the Sinfonia Concertante for violin and viola.
The spiritual and musical qualities that made Pablo Casals an overwhelming cellist also made him a great conductor. That's one of the reasons I'm so happy about this new CD on the Legacy label. Casals leads a performance of Mozart's sublime Sinfonia Concertante that shimmers with exhilarating intensity. The soloists are violinist Joseph Fuchs and violist Lillian Fuchs, the brother and sister team especially admired for their many elegant chamber music recordings. There are several different approaches to the Sinfonia Concertante. In the basic, competent performance, the soloists simply try to stay together. Sometimes, more dramatically, they develop a witty can-you-top-this repartee, like Shakespeare's Beatrice and Benedick or Congreve's Millamant and Mirabelle. But in this performance, Casals inspires the loving soloists to lend each other a heart-filling mutual support. I don't think this performance has ever been available commercially before. It was recorded live in 1953 at Prades, the small village in France near the Spanish border where Casals lived in self-imposed exile after the Spanish Civil War. Casals had vowed to remain musically silent as long as the forces of Franco remained in power in his native Spain. But the violinist and conductor Alexander Schneider proposed to Casals that if he refused to leave Prades, the musical world would come to him. So for the bicentennial of the death of Bach in 1950, Casals agreed to direct and perform in a Bach festival at Prades. This event was such a triumph and meant so much to Casals that other Casals festivals continued at Prades and Perpignan and later in Puerto Rico. Some of the greatest soloists and chamber players of the century participated. Columbia issued an extraordinary series of recordings, now long out of print, that retain an exalted place in any collection lucky enough to include them. One of these recordings, made at the Perpignan Festival in 1951, was an earlier performance of the same Mozart Sinfonia Concertante, conducted by Casals, with William Primrose on the viola and Isaac Stern giving one of his finest violin performances. The version on the new CD with Joseph and Lillian Fuchs, made 2 years later at Prades, seems to me even warmer and more moving. This legacy disc also includes a heavenly performance of Mozart's late masterpiece, the Divertimento in E-flat, his only work for string trio. Joseph and Lillian Fuchs are joined by another musician long associated with Casals, the magnificent French cellist Paul Tortelier. Let me also mention another new recording of Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante on Gunther Schuller's GM label. It's called Grande Sesteto Concertante, and it's actually a surprisingly sensitive arrangement for string sextet, made in 1808, 17 years after Mozart's death, possibly by Mozart's favorite clarinetist, Anton Stadler. The performance by the Minneapolis Artists Ensemble is a model of passionate good taste.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. Most popular novelists around college campuses in the 70s was Tom Robbins. His 1976 novel, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, is now in its 19th printing. It's just been republished by Bantam, along with his other novels, Another Roadside Attraction, Jitterbug Perfume, and Still Life with Woodpecker. Robbins also has a new novel, Skinny Legs and All. Jay Cantor, reviewing the book for the Washington Post, wrote, "I don't read Robbins for his friendly preaching or even the story or the characters, but for the fizz, the style, and the attitude. Robbins' world is filled with the ecstasy of happy hyperbole, metaphor at any cost, and charming fancies." I asked Tom Robbins to read from the opening of Skinny Legs and All.
It was a bright, defrosted pussy willow day at the onset of spring, and the newlyweds were driving cross-country in a large roast turkey. The turkey lay up on its back, as roast turkeys will, submissive, agreeable, volunteering its breast to the carving blade, its roly-poly legs cocked in a stiff but jaunty position, as if it might summon the gumption to spring forward onto its feet. But, of course, it had no feet, which made the suggestion seem both empty and ridiculous, and only added to the turkey's aura of goofy vulnerability. Despite its featlessness, however, its pathetic podalic privation, this roast turkey, or jumbo facsimile thereof, was moving down the highway at 65 miles an hour, traveling faster, farther on its back than many aspiring actresses.
Now, how would you describe your use of imagery?
Pop Baroque.
Meaning?
It comes out of the imagination, you know. It comes out of observation, marinated in imagination.
Now, you started off as a journalist, and I assume you had to do pretty straightforward, factual reporting when you started. How did you get off into such non-literal imagery?
Well, they never really let me do much reporting in journalism. They primarily assigned me to writing headlines.
Oh, really? What kind of headlines would you write?
Well, I wrote the headlines on Dear Abby. And when she came to Seattle, she came to the newspaper, as she often does when she goes to a new city, and she asked to meet the person who was writing the headlines on her columns because they were so different from what she was getting in Des Moines and Cleveland.
Can you give an example? Do you remember any of them?
Oh, I remember one was about some flap that was occurring in California. They were going to remove the Tarzan books from the public schools because Tarzan and Jane weren't married. And the headline said, "Did Tarzan live too high in tree?" That sort of thing.
Well, I'm trying to see if I get it. No, seriously.
Well, he was living in sin, you know, and in the top of that mango tree. And did Tarzan live too high in tree? I don't know. You'd have to have been there.
So you really weren't doing much actual journalism, just headline writing?
Well, later on, I became an art critic, so I did write for the paper in that capacity. But art criticism gives you a lot of room to be nonlinear, and to play with the texture and the color of the language.
So what got you from headline writing to fiction?
Oh, I hesitate to say it in this day and time, but it was probably related, at least somewhat, to my ingestion of 300 micrograms of pure Sandoz lysergic acid diethylamide 25.
So you took some LSD, some of the pure stuff, and that somehow led you to fiction?
No, I'd been writing fiction since I was 5 years old. On my fifth birthday, I received a Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs scrapbook. And instead of pasting pictures in it, I wrote stories. And, of course, at five, I couldn't actually write, so I dictated them to my mother. And she, whenever the muse would strike, she would have to stop her ironing or cooking or whatever she was doing and take dictation. And occasionally, she would change a word here and there to make it, in her opinion, sound better. And when she read the story back to me, I always knew every word that had been changed, and I would throw a tantrum until she put it back the way I had it.
Oh, gee, editors must have had a ball working with you if this
well,
is how you were when you were 5 years old.
I told that story to my editor a few years ago, and he said, "My God, Robbins, you haven't changed in 40 years.
And I think your early books were read especially by people in the counterculture. So to speak. Did you ever feel like part of this group? I know you've often been described as reclusive. I don't really know for a fact how off on your own you've been over the years.
Well, I'm a friendly recluse, and of course it's always more fun to look at somebody else's navel than your own. So I haven't been all that reclusive, but... And I did very much feel a part of the so-called psychedelic community. But still, you had to go in the room and lock the door and do your own work.
Mm-hmm. So getting back to the type of imagery that you use in your writing, would you make a direct connection between that kind of almost surrealistic hyper imagery and the experience of taking LSD?
No, I don't think there's any real connection. That type of, that approach to language has been around in one form or another for a long time by people who probably never had anything stronger than vodka. What psychedelics did for me in a literary sense, if anything, was it just, I think it made it easier for me to move from one level of so-called reality to another, to be less restrictive in what I consider the real world.
In your new novel, an Arab and a Jew open a restaurant in New York, and this is almost some kind of strategy to show that conflicts between Arabs and Jews or Arabs and Israelis can be eased. Why did you want to tackle the Middle East in some metaphoric way?
Because the Middle East is the landscape in which our ultimate fantasies unfold. Christians, Arabs, and Jews all look to the Middle East for some kind of eschatological fulfillment. You know, the apocalypse, Armageddon, the redemption, the second coming. Only the last two scenes in the book actually take place in the Middle East. So what I was really dealing with was the Middle East in the American psyche, the Jerusalem in American consciousness. But the book contrasts, I guess, the rituals of our mythological heritage, which is a mythology that was dense and deep, and a mythology that explained life and death and illuminated the psyche. It contrasts that with the rituals of contemporary mythology, which is a mythology that's shallow and superficial, standardized, probably thoroughly corrupted by commercialism, and that has very few lessons to teach anybody. And this contrast is epitomized in the book by the pitting of the real magic of the Dance of the Seven Veils against the contrived ersatz magic of the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about how many of your early readers, like you, were into the counterculture, into taking LSD. Do you feel that that dated you in any way, in the sense that when that period ended, that people maybe didn't feel that they would connect to you as much?
Well,
I guess I'm wondering if you think that's a danger of being timely or of your time.
Yeah, but all good writers are of their time. Shakespeare was of his time. The problem is with reviewers who like to pigeonhole you, they tend to stick you in a time, in a particular time, and nothing makes my Rh negative blood turn into boiling buttermilk quite so much as being called a 60s writer. I'm no more a 60s writer than Hemingway was a 30s writer. My first novel was set in the 60s. Rolling Stone called it the quintessential novel of the 60s. But since then, I've had very little to do with the 60s. Certainly, my last two books have no connection whatsoever to the 60s.
Can I ask you a financial question? You've had.
I can loan
yeah,
you,
can you loan
maybe
me some money?
$20, but I don't get paid until May 1st.
Are you able to live off of royalties from your books and savings from your books that were bestsellers, or do you have to, while you're writing, also sell pieces to magazines or do other jobs on the side?
No, I live quite well from the proceeds of the sales of my books,
mm-hmm.
better than I ever expected to live. Although I really don't live that much differently than I ever did. I suppose it gives me more mobility. But having money in the bank does give me a great Buddhistic calm.
Well, Tom Robbins, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it was a consummate pleasure.
Tom Robbins' new novel is Skinny Legs and All. It's published by Bantam. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, the Soviet Foreign Minister, Eduard Shevardnadze, has suggested to our leaders that NATO and the Warsaw Pact might possibly coexist in Germany. So we'll have a piece about that. We have a long piece from Danny Zwerdling in Kenya on environmentalism in the developing world. The effort to save a city park in Nairobi has run into some surprising difficulties. Nina Totenberg has an interview with the Iran-Contra Special Prosecutor, Lawrence Walsh. And we have a book about cowboy heroes of the silver screen.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Commentator Maureen Corrigan reads People magazine and the celebrity pages in the newspaper, but recently she had an opportunity to get closer to the stars.
As an English professor, I've met lots of famous authors on the college lecture circuit. E.L. Doctorow, Grace Paley, Eudora Welty, I've sipped sherry and shot the syntax with all of them. But even when I've been in awe of their work, I've never been overwhelmed by meeting literary celebrities. Maybe I suffer from my profession's delusion of superiority. You know, authors only write great books. Academics explain what they mean. When I visited relatives in California last month, I hoped that I'd finally see some real stars. But things started off kind of slow. My first day on the coast, my aunt and uncle took me to Lawrence Welk Village, a retirement community presided over by the Champagne King of Swing. Lawrence Welk was rumored to be out on the golf course, so I posed for a snapshot with his statue instead. That night, my cousin showed me home videos of Ben Vereen's house. Not Ben Vereen, just his house.
My cousin knows Ben Vereen's ex-road manager, and this woman invited my cousin over, with his video cam, when Ben Vereen was out of town. For half an hour, I stared at Ben Vereen's bathroom, kitchen, trophy wall, and bashed-up garage door. It was the most voyeuristic experience I've ever had, and I was getting closer. Towards the end of my stay, I finally saw a live star. A friend who works in the movie industry was showing me around the Fox studios when I spotted Harry Hamlin. For those of you who don't know, Harry Hamlin plays lawyer Michael Cusack on L.A. Law. I watched the show, but I'd never been attracted to him. He has one of those Cro-Magnon foreheads. It makes his character look like he must have flunked the bar exam more than once. Well, I changed my mind about that forehead when I saw Harry Hamlin in the flesh. He was standing by a trailer, surrounded by female crew members. He was so handsome, he looked like another life form. "Be cool," my friend said, but I honestly couldn't breathe as I walked past Harry Hamlin. My friend took me to a cappuccino joint to recover. It was Arnold Schwarzenegger's secret hangout. I asked her, "What hit me back there?" She answered by telling me an inside showbiz story. It seems that the actors who play the murderers and psychopaths on the show America's Most Wanted are always being arrested. People mistake them for the real criminals. "That's what happened to you," my friend said. "You confused Harry Hamlin with his nearly perfect character." It didn't make sense. I'd never liked his character. I think critic Leo Brody, in his smart 1986 book, The Frenzy of Renown, offers a better explanation for the power of fame. He writes, "Famous people glow, and it's a glow that comes from the number of times we've seen the images of their faces now superimposed on the living flesh before us. Harry Hamlin glowed, and I swooned because of the accumulated force of all those Thursday nights when his face has been in my living room. TV newscasters and weather people like Willard Scott glow. So do all the cartoon characters in Disneyland. Hell, even Ben Vereen's furniture glowed by association. Famous authors, on the other hand, don't glow unless they've been on talk shows or had too much sherry. That afternoon, I drank many cappuccinos, but I never got to test out the glow theory on Arnold Schwarzenegger. Conan the Barbarian never showed up.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, and Amy Sallet produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Lugene DeJoseph and Lisa McCullough. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Robert Cullen analyzes recent events in Romania and Lithuania, and political cartoonist Pat Oliphant looks back at a quarter century of caricaturing presidents. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.